I was at the farmer's market this morning, and one of the vendors asked me, "How's your holiday?" And I said, "Not terrible." And I know there was a little bit of fumbling on what I was going to call this podcast. Not that bad, not terrible. I was kind of back and forth with it. But I realize that currently, not terrible is as good as it gets. And it was probably when a friend of mine pointed out, "You say that a lot," that I thought, there's a problem. Because I haven't had a day where I've been like, this is great. What a good day. And I know any day that I wake up is a good day. But in my mind, not terrible had become a good day. And even outside stimuli, whatever it was, nothing could make my day great anymore. And it's also not anybody's responsibility to make my day great. And it's not my responsibility to make anybody's day great. Wow, I love it when a segue works. So I actually did want to talk about codependency today. And I feel like it's a term that's overused. It's almost like depression at this point. Like, oh, I'm such a codependent. Like somehow people wear it as a badge of honor or like you've been in some active combat, you know, if you can say that you're codependent. And I used to feel that way too, because I thought codependency meant that you're the one that's the victim in the situation. That you have a narcissist or an addict or someone that occupies everyone's time, kind of. Like, I feel like everybody has that person in their family, maybe. Or maybe they don't. I don't know. Maybe it's just been my experience that there's always that person that everybody's trying to make better, but actually are just enabling or... But my experience with codependency, I think, started when I was a kid. I was very mature. I am the oldest of four siblings, five now. And I read somewhere that codependency starts when you realize that you're more mature than your parents. I don't know if that was my situation exactly. I don't think it was, really. My parents realized that I was dependable, that I liked to help, or they encouraged those behaviors. I don't know if you're born that way or if your parents kind of mold you into a certain way. But I always wanted to be a part of the adult conversation. There was always a joke in my family that was telephone, telegraph, tell a Jesse, because I was just always around the corner trying to listen to adult conversations, and I wanted to be at the card table, and I wanted to be in the kitchen when they were cooking and what they were talking about, and then I wanted to be where they were talking about things. I don't know if I thought that held power, like knowing information held power. Or if I thought I could contribute to the conversation, I'm not sure, but yeah, that is the joke. I was always just ready to be a part of the adult party. And, you know, of course I, the last place I wanted to be was at the kids' table. So maybe being in those situations, they started giving me chores or things to do to occupy me or get me out of their way. But when my brother was born, I think that was probably when I started helping a lot. And my parents saw that. They saw that it somehow made me happy. It fulfilled something in me if I was helping. And somehow, sometimes, these things get manipulated in our childhood. Well, things that we enjoyed as a child get manipulated as we grow up and become adults. And I love to help. I love to help. But somehow, that's how I received love, I thought. I think. I still think this way. If I can't help you, then how could you love me? If I can't be of service to you, then why would you love me? So I overextend and I do extra and I want to be helpful, but then in my worst moments, I become very resentful because I don't feel like they have helped or been there as much as I have for them. And that's a very self-centered way of thinking. And I don't think this way all the time. Like I said, it's at my worst moments, when I'm at my lowest, when I'm self-pity and just looking for validation from other people. And that's a part of my codependent behavior. And I think everybody's codependency comes out in different ways. Mine does come out with wanting to help, helping, overextending, and then being sad when it's not reciprocated. Or another way is, here, this is how I'm going to show you that I love you. How could you not know that this is how I show love? This is how I show love. Why do I have to say that I love you? Like, this is what I do. I'm going to help. And then for some reason, if someone tries to return the love or the favor or the act of kindness, I don't want it. I don't think I'm worthy. I know that's another cop-out thing to say. And if somebody else was saying what I'm saying right now, I'd be like, psh, you're nuts. Like, get over yourself. And I mean, I do. I have that internal dialogue all the time. But there is something wrong. Something happened. And I'm not saying like a trauma, but somehow how I grew up was, if you don't need anything from anybody, then you're doing the right thing. But if people need you, then you have value. Okay. I think that's the first time I've been able to put it all into words like that. But codependency may have served me, or these roots of becoming a codependent adult served me as a child, because I wanted to be helpful and I wanted to be a part of the adult group, and I wanted to be wanted and I wanted to be needed. And I identified with this somehow. And I think it's because the women in my family, both of my grandmothers, my aunts, my mother, they all fulfilled those predetermined gender roles that were given, but they appeared to love doing it. They loved to cook and clean and care for their family and wrap all the gifts and let the men lay on the couch and watch football and eat the meals that they had so lovingly prepared. They appeared like they liked to do that. And there's a part of me that likes to do that. I do. I enjoy feeding people. It feeds me to literally feed people. It feeds my soul. And I love the act of cooking. Just that it's not mindless. It occupies my mind in a very positive way, so that I don't get overwhelmed with these kinds of feelings. But I do. I love to prepare a meal and watch people enjoy it. And there's something therapeutic about literally giving life to the people that you love. But somehow the women in my family romanticized this, or it was in my eyes romanticized, that I was like, oh, this is what I want. I want to be a mother. I want to be a mother. I want to be a mother. And that was kind of the only thing I ever wanted to be, was a mother. And it wasn't until I realized I never had that daydream of being someone's wife, or I just wanted to be a mother. And it probably, a little bit of it was because, you know, my parents were divorced, and I don't have a lot of memories of my mother and father being a couple. My grandma and grandpa were divorced, and they were always really friendly. They liked each other. They were really nice to each other. My father's parents, that was a very bumpy situation, but she lived and breathed her children. So they hit it really well, their issues. So from those women, I learned that being the mother was the most rewarding part of this, of these female roles, these gender specific roles that we have. Being a mother was the most fulfilling of all of those things. And I lived with my mother until the fourth or fifth grade, and then I lived with my father. So I'm very balanced in that, being raised by a single mother, being raised by a single father, but then having this tribe, this village of aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents that contributed to my upbringing. I'm moving past any issues or any trauma that the majority of us experience in our childhood. I'm very fortunate that I have this mass of people that love me and support me, and regardless of how mentally unstable we all are every day or at some points through our lives, we love each other fiercely. Fiercely. So I have this balance between my parents and this family that just loves each other so much that there's points where we probably want to strangle each other, if that makes sense. And if it does, it's because you're from a big Italian family too. So being a parent or caretaking of children in general, not always just children, but people who needed love, giving love. I just told this to my kids the other day. Sometimes we have to love the people who don't show us love, because they're the people who need the love the most. And that was a hard, hard thing to say. As my family transitions and we move through some really, really hard times right now, sometimes it's really hard to just crack your chest open and just literally say out loud with your arms spread wide, there's nothing but love coming out of my heart right now to you and to you and to you and to you, to people who very specifically have broken my heart, just trying to pour love toward them. And not concentrate on the fact that my broken heart is sending them love. But it's just my heart. And the experiences that have broken it is what makes it what it is. And it might be in a million pieces some days, but there's still love in there. And I can't meet anger and hurt with more anger and hurt. two wrongs don't make a right. I feel like that's the only time I have ever used that sentence and it made sense, you know, where people are like, two wrongs don't make a right, you know. But I actually, that's anger and hurt meeting with anger and hurt. Like that is the example of two wrongs don't make a right. And it's not, there's no room for light and love in that situation. So in those moments where I'm realizing where my codependency roots and that I was, that became my love language, was helping people and being a part of my family and, you know, mimicking the things that I was seeing my grandmothers and my mother and my aunts do. That served me as a child. That somehow, regardless of what else was going on in my life, became a coping mechanism for me, was mimicking the good things, which was being a mother and taking care of your family and those things. But as I matured, and as I got involved in my first relationship as a teenager, and eventually, you know, dated and got married and, well, had children, got married, got divorced, just all these things that what was supposed to be rooted in love became the opposite. Instead of just loving people to love people and taking care of your family and showing love through doing these things, it became, well, didn't you see what I've done for you? Don't you know that this is the way I show love? Well, what have you done to show me that you love me? Oh, you say you love me? That doesn't mean anything. You haven't done anything to show me you love me. And it's not even in material things, it's just in actions. Like that's how I speak, is in actions, that your words mean very little. And I'm not saying that that's right, but I'm working through that and believing people when they say that they love me. Instead of just waiting for them to show me that they love me. So I've never been in a situation with I've never been in a situation with an addict, but I've had different degrees of addiction around me, and that in some way or another, I have enabled them. But my codependency goes a little different in that my value lies in your opinion of me. And if you don't like me, you're going to know that I'm going to lose sleep over it, that I'm going to cry about it, that I'm going to go above and beyond and exhaust myself to find out why you don't like me, what I can do to change your mind, instead of just saying, your opinion of me is none of my business. When I first heard someone say that, I was like, that may be the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Absolutely. What every person thinks of me is absolutely my business. And I deserve to know, and I deserve the opportunity to change your mind. And you better change your mind when I show you how wonderful I am. I know. It's asinine. It's insane. It's, how can someone possibly live their life being so consumed with the opinions of others, and not even only the opinions that other people have about you, but the opinions people have politically, or socially or morally, whatever it is, like that affects me, like deeply affects me, to the point that I can't, like, it'll stay with me for days. For days it'll stay with me. Someone said something politically incorrect, you know, over a holiday situation, celebration, someone used a racial slur or made a homophobic joke, or, I mean, those things really, really stick with me and they bother me and it hurts my heart. And I go through that pattern of, well, could I educate them? Is it worth my time? I should probably just keep my mouth closed, grab a beer out of the refrigerator, sit in the corner and sulk and really bring this party down. Which, I mean, these are just thoughts that I have. I don't necessarily do that. I try to at least power through the party and then, you know, go home and cry in my bed by myself, you know, like normal people, like normal codependent people do. But I also realized that in being codependent, it's like this exchange or this nonverbal agreement that I'm going to work harder on you than you are going to work on you or us. It feels like a very one-sided relationship. And most of the time it is. There's a giver and a taker it's just really easy to live that kind of life and it becomes an addiction. It really does. This literally consumes all of my thoughts, all the time. What do I want to say here? When you put other people first all of the time, it teaches the people around you that you're second. It's almost like it goes back to the same. People treat you the way you allow them to treat you. And like I'm saying right now, like I've for a long time I adopted this codependent role as somehow being victimized, but I have victimized myself. This is my doing and I have the power to change it. I just didn't realize what an addiction it was and how much of my life it controlled. And that part is terrifying because I've always considered myself to acknowledge, okay, this is an afflicted emotion. Okay, this is an afflicted emotion. You've identified the emotion. All right. Now feel it. Feel it for the time that you think is appropriate enough, and then you need to move past it. And now what's the next step? But with codependency, it's different because I feel like it's everybody around me. It's the staff at my kids' schools. It's the people that I work with. It's my family. It's my friends. And my in-laws have affected me the most in these situations. And it's been so unhealthy for me and unhealthy for my relationships that I think that it has caused me not only heartache, but it has caused me emotional pain. It's caused me physical pain, physical ailments. And I think they call those samskaras. Like those are incidents or traumas or, and I, when I use the word trauma, I don't mean like you have big traumas. They call it, I think they, in the therapy field, they say big T's and little T's. So you got a big trauma and you got a little trauma. I've experienced a lot of small traumas in my life. I've experienced some big traumas. I think that just as a point of reference for you guys, I've never been abused, physically or sexually abused. I think that there's been some moments where there's been some emotional or some emotional abuse, probably not purposefully and not every day and not to the point that it completely broke my spirit, but just that. Just things, you know, like it almost sometimes emotional abuse just becomes a part of your relationships, different relationships. It can be passive aggressive and undermining and very, very subtle. And it's to the point that you don't even know. It's like as like a Stockholm syndrome sometimes, where you don't even like it's so quiet and manipulative that you don't even realize that it's going on. That's a terrifying thing to happen too. But with my, I had an incident happen about a week ago, and the immediate feelings of rejection and hurt made me fall deep into, an isolated depression, because it was very, very specific to this situation. So you know those moments where like something doesn't go your way and it kind of spirals out of control and you just kind of that immediate, that guttural, oh my gosh, I feel so hurt and I feel rejected and I didn't recover. I still haven't recovered from it. But I feel like this was a really good lesson in my codependent tendencies. And it's, I mean, like it, this is so deep and ingrained in me to be so concerned about other people's opinions of me. I mean, this is just like people very close to me basically said, we don't like you. We don't want to be around you. Okay. It was devastating. It was absolutely devastating. But in my mind, I'm like, well, they must not really know me, or they must not really know my truths and my, they're like just making all these excuses for why they don't like me. When the initial hurt of rejection, and rejection is such a high school feeling. It is such a, like you don't, like as an adult, I feel like the only times I have ever felt rejection, like rejection of somebody going, okay, no, you're not good enough. We don't like what we see. Like the only time you feel that as an adult usually is like in a job interview and you don't get the job. Like that's a pretty normal feeling of rejection as an adult. But someone that's close to you and just says, no. Like, we don't like you as a person. That takes you right back to, like, not being invited to that party in high school. Or, you know, the guy that you really like doesn't ask you on a second date because you got to, I don't really like her at all. You know, that type of thing. That rejection. I know, like those are very immature. But that's where I went, was that feeling was right back to high school, that feeling of rejection. And what can I do to fix it? But then you have to, like, okay, take a step back and go, what the hell are you going to fix? What could you possibly do that would make these people go, yeah, we're going to change our mind and we've decided that we want to hang out? Like, as what little self-respect I have, there's no way that we can go back on this. Not right now, anyway. And I even say that, but like, if we could have it all out on the table and have a real, genuine, honest exchange and talk about this, I would absolutely do that. But like, right now, I have to sit in this mess. And I think I say that to myself about every 30 seconds right now when I'm feeling my worst, when I have cried myself into some kind of hysteria, which that's new for me. That hasn't happened until, I mean, I'm going to say like the last month or so, I have cried so hard that I have cried myself. It has to be a form of hysteria. I mean, like, I feel like there's audiovisual hallucinations. There are thoughts that I've never had before, terrifying thoughts. The thoughts of how do I make this stop? Well, the only way I could make this stop would be to not physically be here anymore. To even have that thought, that's terrifying in itself. And here's the thing. This is 100% solely based on someone else's opinion of me that has wrecked my world to the point that I don't know if I want to live anymore. We may have crossed over into something a little more serious than codependency here. I'm not sure. Like I said, definitely not a doctor. I have my PhD in nothing. In life, I feel like I've had a lot of life experience. But compared to somebody else, I probably have zero life experience. So the next step in working through my very seriously debilitating codependency, we'll just call it that until we find a better word for it, I have to find a way to detach from relationships and people that were once very, very important to me. I have to detach with love. And that's a very, very hard thing to do. Maybe it's not as hard when they don't want to talk to you anymore and they don't want you to be a part of their life, but I mean, you have to actively detach from multiple people. This is just something that's very current and topical right now in my life because it just happened. But there are lots of people that I for my mental wellness, I have to detach with love. Some of them I should actually just detach from, period, and move the hell on with my life. But I want to make the choice to detach with love because when there's a void of love, there's that just leaves that open space for hurt and anger and resentment to grow. And I always wonder, so If something is void of love, if your heart is void of love, does that mean that that's just it's empty? There's nothing that's there? Or does there have to be, I mean, if your glass is empty, like maybe, like we'll pretend red Kool-Aid is love. We're going to pour some red Kool-Aid in there, right? All right, red Kool-Aid. I like the way it looks. Cranberry juice, whatever. Just something that represents love to you. I haven't had red Kool-Aid in years, but if I could have some cherry Kool-Aid right now, I'd drink some cherry Kool-Aid. Probably sugar-free kind. I don't know. It's probably full of chemicals. Oh my gosh, you guys. Okay. So you pour your Kool-Aid out of the cup and you set it on the counter. That doesn't mean that you have to put like gasoline in the cup instead. You know, I mean, you could just leave it empty. So maybe that's the thing is that, but I don't know if that works with your heart. Like my heart is too vulnerable right now. Like right now at this, in this stage of detachment, I have to keep love in my heart as I detach. Maybe there will come a time where I can just disconnect and not be, I don't want to be void. I mean, I would rather feel love, but I think that disconnecting part comes later on. And there's another word that I'm missing here, and maybe it'll come to me later. But so right now, as I disconnect, I'm disconnecting with love in my heart. And whenever I have a negative feeling or emotion or afflicted feelings or emotion, things toward those people, I have to meet it with love. Like laugh all you want, close my eyes, press my chest up, and literally imagine little emoji hearts just flying out of my chest, just going towards them. Like literally going up, the kissy face, maybe like the kissy face emoji, just kissing them on the cheek. Like these are exercises that I have done to help myself stop crying, to stop feeling sorry for myself, to stop feeling hurt and anger and rejection. These are the exercises that I have come up with, which, I mean, and I know that this sounds silly too, but there are times where I am sobbing uncontrollably and I just make myself smile. And you know that fake smile that you would do for school pictures in middle school? Like, I don't want to smile. I don't want anybody to think that I am happy about anything going on right now. I hate life. I hate everybody. I'm 14 years old. You know, that smile where you literally just like, you just kind of like raise your cheeks and squeeze your eyes together and show your teeth a little bit. I've done that when I've been sobbing, just thinking like, okay, well, like I'm sure in some goofy magazine somewhere in some doctor's office waiting room, I saw, well, if you actually physically make yourself smile, like it releases endorphins and you know, that kind of thing. So that's what I've done. I don't know if it's helped, but it almost makes me giggle because I look ridiculous crying these great big, is it crocodile or alligator tears? I don't know either. These tears, these great big tears, and then like doing my eighth grade picture smile. Oh, my dad comes home and is like, why don't you smile? Why can't you really smile? I just these ridiculous exercises that I do, just trying to detach. And detachment isn't unhealthy. In this situation, detachment isn't unhealthy. But with detachment, I'm realizing you just don't detach. You have to, a part of detaching is setting boundaries. There's new boundaries that you have to set in these relationships. And if those boundaries are blocking someone from your phone, not answering their calls, just, I know that sounds very surface level, like boundary setting, but I'm like, the boundary part is new to me. Like I'm still trying to detach with love, which means your opinion of me is none of my business, but I'm sending you all the light and all the love. And this is something else that I do. I've considered myself a spiritual orphan for a while now. I don't identify with any religion or any God or or any spiritual practice right now. I'm exploring options. I don't identify yet. But in my heart, if I have someone close to me and they believe in God and they pray and they're experiencing hardship, and I know that the simple act of like, not even like, even if I don't think that prayer is beneficial at that time or whatever I'm feeling at the moment, it's not all the time, it's sometimes. I'm having a real hard time hanging on to any feelings lately, guys. It's literally a second at a time. But if I know that this person is a child of God, and whichever God they believe in, I will pray for them to their God. Hey, God, that my friend so and so believes in, she's calling on you and she needs you, and this is a moment where we need you to come through here and show her light and love and take this burden off of her and all these things. I just, like, if that's how you get down, I support how you get down. So the way I get down right now is like the goofy exercises of a little bit of smiling, a little bit of this. But here's the thing too. I've also been in such depression that I have screamed out to, I think, the God that was built up in my head as a kid. And I've said, why would you do this? Why would you do this? What is so important that I'm learning in these moments that you would make me feel this way? That you would make me feel like I shouldn't be on this planet anymore? Because the God that I have been taught and raised with is a punishing God. And that is very hard to break free from. I don't get to use that anymore. I mean, I don't. That's been a very, very hard thing for me to break away from my childhood, is that God is a punishing God. It's fire and brimstone, it's damnation and hell, and just, so somehow I think that I deserve these feelings. Because that's what God does. He punishes you. Do I really want to believe that? No, I don't. I don't. But in my heart, that's another thing that I'm working through and another thing that I'm feeling. But I have screamed out to that God that I thought was punishing me and wanting me to feel all these things and going, why? Why? Why do I have to feel this? This is really that necessary for me to become stronger? Another thing that I've experienced through these lessons in codependency are that being codependent in my situation, in my experience, has gone hand in hand with being very sensitive and very empathetic. I hesitate to say empath, but but somewhere in my life, someone or something or me, I decided that my inner voice and my intuition and my gut feeling was wrong and I shouldn't listen to it, and it's wrong, it's wrong, it's wrong. And I think I know where that comes from, actually, and I hesitate to say, but Have you ever been in a situation with a small child and a small child has said something and like repeated maybe something that you said that you wish that they hadn't, like embarrassed you? Oh my gosh, I can't believe they said that. I don't know where they got that. I'm so sorry. Da da da. But in all actuality, you know that they're repeating something they heard you say. But when that child watches that exchange of you going, basically, you're a liar, then you're making that child think that even their own reality, like something that really happened, you're not only making them doubt themselves, you're making them doubt their reality. It's almost like a form of gaslighting. Like, or it's the same way when your child said, "I don't feel good," and you say, yes, you do, you're fine. Okay. Or I'm sad. What do you have to be sad about? I think that that happened a lot in my life, and that made me not trust my own intuition or my feelings or my inner voice, or my aunt even says, like, the Holy Spirit. Like, maybe that's where I got sideways with religion too, was whoever was speaking to me, whether it was a spiritual guide or the Holy Spirit, something happened in my life that made me doubt that. So when I have these feelings of extreme sensitivity to the feelings of the people around me, extreme empathy, extreme compassion, even if I feel in my guts like, oh my gosh, this has got to be right, this is right, I go, no, it's not right. Don't be ridiculous. You can't read these people. That's not a part of this. It's not. It also comes with being in relationships where I have said, hey, did this happen? Like, I feel like this happened, or so-and-so said this happened, and actually just being lied to and going, oh, wow, well, I must have had it wrong. Okay, my bad, sorry. But in all actuality, that person was just lying and making me, like, just completely talked me out of whatever truth I thought I knew. So all these things are just feeding this insecurity, which I feel like I actually have. I don't have a gift, but a part of that codependency and that empathetic nature is being able to read people and seeing, okay, this person's uncomfortable. What can I do to make this person feel better? Or, oh, I just saw her, put her hands together and rub them and blow her warm breath in her. She must be cold. I better go get her blanket or ask her if she wants a sweater. Just like these little tiny things and being at dinners and, okay, that person just took their last bite. I'm going to get up. I'll take their plate. I'll get them a cup of coffee. Just reading people to the point that it's exhausting, A. But this also, so many of these things are tied together. I don't know if you guys have heard of HSP, highly sensitive people. I think that feeds into it a little bit too, because you're very, very sensitive to some people are. I get worked up. I don't get worked up. It's the pump up that I have to do to get ready to be in a crowd or be with a larger group of people, or the anticipation and the anxiety that comes before those events and after those events, the exhaustion that comes with it, because being codependent and being empathetic and constantly wanting to people please, it sounds very martyr-y, you know, like, look at all these things that I want to do to take care of these people, blah, blah, blah. Okay, we all know this analogy where you're on an airplane, and when the flight attendant says, okay, if in case of an emergency, your mask will drop, da 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 da, you have to put on your own mask first. If you don't have your mask on first, if you're not giving yourself life and oxygen first, how do you expect to help anybody around you? You can't. You have to take care of you first. And that is not selfish. Self-care is not selfish. Putting all of your energy out there towards people who don't want your energy, who don't want your presence, who don't need it, who don't deserve it. That's going to kill you. Like, these are situations that manifest physically. This becomes autoimmune disease. This becomes ulcers. This becomes heart conditions. This becomes severe depression where you are in bed for days. That's what I'm experiencing. A level of depression that I have never known. Because I think that my worth lies in the opinion of others. And I am wrong. My worth does not lie in the opinion of others. My worth is mine. I determine my worth. I don't have to give a list of characteristics that say, this is why I'm worthy. This is why I'm worthy to receive love. This is why I'm worthy to be in a relationship that involves mutual respect. I know that I'm worthy of those things. Even on the days that I am my worst self, I know that, you know what, maybe my pants rip, maybe I step in a great big puddle, maybe something happens and I'm like, you know what, you were kind of a jerk today. You that was a little karma reminder that says, hey, you know what, stop, don't. That's okay. Those moments are okay. Those grounding moments that says, hey, snap out of it. That's okay. But to beat yourself up for years and years based on the opinions of others, that is no way to live. Be what you want. Like attracts like. If you want people to love and respect you, and I don't even like that. I don't even like to say, like, respect you. I don't know. Like, love. Like, it's not even about respect for me. There's something negative about that word. Maybe we'll dive into that another time, but if you want to feel love, if you want to receive love, like, I don't even say, like to say, if you want to be loved, like, that doesn't define you either. Who loves you doesn't define you. Do you love you? You know the qualities that you love about yourself. You know what makes you your best self. And so often you think of, no, that's selfish. I can't do that. I don't want to do that. You know the actions and the words and the thoughts that ground you and bring you back to your highest self. Not even your best self. Best self, don't like that either. I don't mean to be throwing out around a lot of I don't likes, but your highest self, at which you identify with your higher power the most, which that connection between you and your higher power, that connection between you and your highest self, that's all one and the same, or it's connected. You know those things and those actions and those thoughts. You know what you need. Don't expect it from someone else. You be your biggest fan. You love you. And you will receive love. But in that same breath, giving love, giving compassion, and giving kindness will give you what you need. And that's where it gets fuzzy for me. It's not about taking care of people. It's not about, like not the physical act of taking care of people or the just some, whatever way that you know that it's untainted love and kindness. There's no attachment with it. Do you see what I'm saying? There's no expectations or attachment when you send love and kindness and compassion to other people. Like that's as small as a thought, or that's as small as not thinking negatively about that person. And that's a part of the detachment and the boundaries. It's just all so connected. And I feel like there could be episodes upon episodes upon episodes about this. But I'm going to leave you with this. Love, compassion, kindness. When it flows out of you to others, it will find its way back to you. Thanks for listening to Not Terrible with Jess Hooker. You've been listening to Not Terrible with Jess Hooker in conjunction with The Chick McGee Show and the Off the Air podcast. Recorded in the Front Room Studios, this has been a Waco production.